Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to our regulars. Welcome to our Kollel fellows, our rabbis. It's great to bring everybody together. This topic this afternoon that we're going to focus on is a topic which is very personal to me because it's really part of my identity personally. It's part of where my family comes from. It's part of how I see myself as a Jewish person. So it deeply resonates with me. It also, and I'm curious, you'll see at the end of this story, if it resonates with you, it also helps me because as somebody who is both religious and involved in together studying about the Holocaust, navigating that complicated, oh no, Cecilia's locked out. That would be very bad. We were worried about you, Cecilia. We're glad you're here.
Do I have to be warned?
No. So, as a religious person, how do we navigate, you know, and as we've talked about actually over the years, and I've shared with some of you, sometimes this work, it can be difficult emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, you know, preparing, and, you know, I always try to share something new, and every time you uncover something new, it's just, at least for me, I don't know how you do this on a regular basis, it just can tear your heart in 1,000 pieces. So this idea that we're going to focus on today will address, to some extent, how we cope with, how we manage in our lives today in light of this reality that you're so immersed in on a regular basis in terms of the Holocaust. So the point of departure for our discussion today, which is going to be focused on Chassidus, and Chassidim, which is a vastly wide and broad topic, but we're going to bring it in a very specific lens, begins with this book. This book is entitled Souls on Fire, okay, by Elie Wiesel. So for those who are on the email list, I hope you had a chance to pick it up. If you didn't get it, I'll send it to you, and it's in the packet you'll get in a second. Elie Wiesel, in the early 70s, in 1972... wrote this book called Souls on Fire. It's a beautiful book. Portraits and Legends of Hasidic Masters. 1972. And what it is not, it's not an academic work. It's really a, oh, 1 second. I want to get that door. It's really a, it's a thought-provoking, meaningful expression of family history, so to speak. It's not historical. It's legend and lore where he talks about specific Hasidic masters over the generations and their personality, their stories, interesting things that happened to them. In the back of this book, he has a fascinating chart. The chart is the name of the Hasidic master. So he starts, Hasidus was founded, this movement of this spiritual Jewish religious movement was founded by Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov in the 18th century. So he has a column on the left-hand side. You see here who the Hasidic master was, when they lived. So first it was the Baal Shem and his student, the Maggid of Mezrich, and afterwards Rabbi Elimelech of Lizhensk. The second column is what's going on in the Jewish world at that time. Then he has a third column, what's going on in the world at that time. So, you know, the War of the Spanish Succession. And then what's going on in the arts. So you can actually see the different strata of life that are going on parallel to the stories that he's telling you. These Hasidic, what you call in Yiddish, we call the Meiselach. Stories and legends about these Hasidic masters. And he dedicates the book to whom? Anybody can guess to whom Elie Wiesel, what's that? What's that? Right, his father. That's the first dedication. My father, an enlightened spirit, believed in man. And then the second dedication is to my grandfather. His grandfather was Chassid. My grandfather, a fervent Chassid, believed in God. One taught me to speak, the other to sing. Both loved stories. And when I tell mine, I hear their voices, whispering from beyond the silenced storm. So we know what that's a reference to. They are what links the survivor to their memory. So this is a very powerful dedication in general that you could probably use at some point in your tour, the idea that stories link the survivor to their memory. That's Elie Wiesel's dedication of this book. So that's the background. So here's the central question. Why did Elie Wiesel write this book? Why? And why did he write it when he wrote it? We know everybody in this room is familiar with many of Elie Wiesel's works, but this one is particularly interesting. So if you open your packets, the first packet you'll see, which we're going to come back to, we're not going to deal with this first. This is a book review, and this, I think, as you know, our kolol is affiliated with Yeshiva University, with the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, so part of YU, they give me special library access. So this is, if you would have opened the New York Times, this is not a text, this is a PDF of what it looked like if you opened the New York Times on March 10th, 1972. This is a book review by Thomas Lask with God as a Familiar. So that already gives us a little bit of insight into what the soul of Chassidus is about the closeness with God, the familiarity with God, the connection in a person's real life. That's this first book review, which we're going to come back to way at the end. But I want you to skip to the next page, turn the packet over, which is the article that I sent out for those who got it by email. This is a later article, a second book review. I'm sorry, an earlier one. This was March 5th, 1972, by a guy by the name of Charles Silberman, who is an author, sociologist type of guy. And he writes a book review of Elie Wiesel's Souls on Fire that when I saw this article, I'm like, oh, we have to talk about this. What is the subtitle of his article? How to Live Joyously When There Are No Answers. I don't know, I'm speculating. Elie Wiesel is in the world of truth. He's in what we would call in Yiddish the Olam HaEmes, so we can't ask him. And this author, Charles Silberman, didn't ask him, but he theorizes. He says, I'll tell you why Elie Wiesel wrote this book, because this was one of his ways of coping with the Holocaust, of coming to terms with the Holocaust and living on day by day. So he says, I'll invite you, you'll take the packet home, you'll read the rest of it if you haven't read it yet. Good afternoon, Annette. He says, why? Look at the last, you're on page number, what is the number, two? Page number two, that's cut off by the staple. Nice. It's that strange wood engraving. But why Hasidism? Last column on the right side. Does it offer Wiesel anything more than a comforting nostalgia? More to the point, can these 18th century and 19th century Eastern European Jewish mystics really speak to the late 20th century Americans? And I would say us in 2019? Can they offer anything relevant to our concerns in the year 1972? He says, absolutely. In the year 1972, go down a few lines, one hardly need argue the limits of pure rationality. Who wants to pick up reading? Next paragraph, what then? Go ahead, Shem.
What then does Chassidim have to offer? Not answers, as El suggests, but a way to live joyously.
When
there are no answers, part of Hasim's appeal to Wiesel is that it does not pretend to answer the unanswerable, nor is a stranger to melancholy and despair, even loss of faith.
Bingo. So what do we have here? We have the Holocaust, which is an unanswerable spiritual question. So you know what we need? We need a path to be able to live with that question. And that's what he found in Hasidism. If you look in the back of the book, he has a coda, you could call it. Having reached the end of this first pilgrimage to the sources of Hasidic experience, the narrator feels a need to explain himself briefly. Elie Wiesel says, let me open my heart to you. Let me tell you what I feel. If only to define the meaning and motivation of his undertaking. He says, obviously, this is not a scholarly work. It's based, actually, on talks that he gave, I think, at the 92nd Y and at the Sorbonne. Not to be confused with each other, just saying. He says, I could have composed this in a lot of different ways, but I just wanted you to understand the world that I came from, the world that my family came from, the world that my grandfather came from. And this is, he says, the best way. Telling it through stories was the best way that I can communicate it. And so he talks about what Hasidus means in terms of values, what it means to live in a life of poverty and yet still have joy and beauty. He talks about how in this universe, beggars are princes, the mute are sages. You can bring joy into life, even in, you know, Hasidim in many communities, they lived in the most wretched, horribly downtrodden conditions, and yet they created a community that was supporting others and taking care of the specific people who weren't as fortunate, who were down and out, and what it means to have love. He even writes in this note something to the extent of the people who destroyed that world would never merit to live the kind of life that the Hasidim lived. The life that they destroyed in Eastern Europe of these Hasidic communities, that kind of living that was destroyed, it was beyond what the perpetrators could, that nobility and the kind of humanity, they could never have even strive for that. They didn't even deserve to have a world like that. It's such a beautiful description of the values and the humanity. And he says, all of these experiences, they cannot be transmitted by the word. There are those that must be transmitted from a being to a being by a whisper or a glance. But at the end of the day, it's about the stories that are convey this kind of living. And this is the tradition. These are the values that Elie Wiesel is trying to bring to life through these Hasidic stories. So what I'm taking away from this is, here's a man who is a deeply spiritual person. Elie Wiesel was a profoundly spiritual man, a profoundly Jewish and spiritual person, and religious at that. And he's saying, you know what, when I look at this ugly face of destruction, you know what I want to tell people? I don't want to tell them that the world is chaos. I want to tell them that they're within that world, the world that was and that we could still create, there is meaning, there is beauty. So turn to the next page. He talks about how people, they can live with questions. On the left-hand column here on page 3, a man came to the Heliger Reb Pinchas of Koritz. The Koritzer was one of the early Hasidic masters. He says, I'm struggling. I have so many doubts on the first column. I have so many difficulties. So Reb Pinchas of Koritz, he says to the man, you know, I had the same problem that you did. I also had a lot of doubts. I also had religious challenges. So what happened? He says, I'm on the fourth paragraph on the left-hand column, where it starts, Reb Pinchas ben Koritz of Koritz replied, know that what is happening to you also happened to me. When I was your age, I stumbled over the same difficulties. I too was filled with questions and doubts. I tried study, prayer, meditation in vain, fasting, penitence, silence in vain. My doubts remain doubts. My questions remain open, impossible to proceed. Then one day, I learned that Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, would be coming to our town. Curiosity, led me to the house where he was praying. He turned around, and the intensity in his eyes overwhelmed me. I knew he was not looking at me alone, yet I knew that I was less alone. Suddenly, without a word, I was able to go home, open the Talmud, and plunge into my studies once more. You see, said Reb Pinchas of Koritz to his disciple, the questions remain questions. My doubts were still as heavy with anguish, but I was able to continue. Contradictory, yes, but as Wiesel writes, quote, Hasidism does not fear contradictions, teaching instead that contradictions are an intrinsic part of man and of life. Like most Jewish mystical movements, Hasidism is a movement that like most Jewish mystical movements and unlike most Oriental, Hasidism is a mysticism that emphasizes the here and now, a search for the invisible and the eternal by way of the mundane and the visible. So now go back to the previous paragraph, previous page, the tiny paragraph on the left side where the wood carving is. Look on the in the interesting observation that he writes, the second column here at the bottom. Like a true existentialist, Wiesel is relentless in insisting that man must himself create the meaning he wants to derive from faith. Unlike most existentialists, he is equally relentless in repudiating absurdity. His central theme, I'm on the third column here under the wood graving, is that in fact that man owes it to himself to reject despair, to take that and make something out of it, to dance in a circle, to sing together, to create a supportive environment, to create a life of joy, despite the contradictions, despite all of the questions. This, to me, was such a powerful message. That's the thesis that Elie Wiesel says that Hasidism introduces to the conversation about the Holocaust. It's the feeling that God is a part of life, and that means there will be contradictions and questions that go unanswered, but that's not an impediment to, or it, we can transcend that difficulty by still creating a life of joy and meaning and profound spirituality and devotion. That's what I wanted to share with us today. Questions, comments, or observations? And then we're going to get to one example. We've talked about some Hasidic masters in the past. I want to give one specific example of resistance, actually in a work detail, not in a camp. I'll get to in a second. Any questions, comments, or observations? Yeah.
I have a comprehension question.
Yes.
When you say a central theme, man owes it to himself to reject despair, I was originally getting the feeling that you should be with despair. So that despair is part of humanity, it's part of man.
So what he's saying is that existentialists, and I tried to do a little bit of research. I'm not a philosopher, so I had to actually do some research as to what existentialism is. But apparently, a big part of this theory, I went online. They have actually some of these like online tutorials. They have classes on. So I took one of these little existential for idiots. So that was I was spot on. So they describe how existentialists basically say, you know, the world is chaos, it's absurdity, and it's despair. And so the only thing that you can do is create meaning for yourself, because you basically say that the world has no meaning. The world is absurd. And what we're saying, Elie Wiesel is saying, is no, the world is not absurd. The world has contradictions. But we need to know that both, number one, the world has meaning inherently, it's not absurd. And number two, we are responsible to add that meaning. So that's why the presentation here is that it's quasi-existentialist and that we need to create the meaning, but it's rejecting the other side that says that everything is in chaos. There is meaning to it. If you're looking for more thoughts on this, I'm in the middle of a really dense but amazing book by Jordan B. Peterson. Jordan B. Peterson is a very prominent psychologist and author at the University of Toronto. He is the man. He wrote a new book called 12 Rules for Life, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. And he is a deeply religious person. He's not Jewish, but he's deeply, deeply religious. And a lot of his themes, an antidote to chaos, is to say, we're not going to just say that the world is chaos and that's okay. No, the world has meaning. We need to overcome the challenges that are out there and lead a meaningful life. And so what Elie Wiesel is saying is that a life of joy, a life of devotion, that is a way to create meaning in what otherwise you could just despair and say, look, the world is horrible, life is terrible. Yeah.
Thank you. You were talking about stages of grief, moving from the why to the why. So he's really saying, use this to move from the why to the what.
Yes. Right? Exactly. Yes. So what Mickey is reminding us of, we had an essay that we once studied from Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, where he contrasted struggling with why questions versus struggling with what questions. Why did God make this happen? So that's exactly what we're saying, is we don't know the answer to that question. And we can't know the answer to that question in this world. But what do we do? Do we just despair? Do we just say the world is meaningless and we subscribe to nihilism and just say that there's nothing to live for? Or do we say, no, there is a path of living joyously. That, and that's part of the uniqueness of this, is that it is a celebratory type of living. Yeah, what were you going to add?
These are important for these studies.
Yes.
Since then, I mean, the world is just as absurd and contradictory, maybe more, I don't know, but we have more information faster. So these, I'm more isolated, enclaves of joy could exist then.
Great question. So I would say two things. The question was, what does this phenomenon mean today? This was written in the early 70s. I would say it's interesting that if you look just demographically in the Jewish world, the growth of Hasidism is explosive. It's explosive. That's number one. I could tell you, my grandmother, Aleha Shalom, my maternal grandmother, so she grew up on a farm in rural Pennsylvania outside of Scranton. My late aunt, Aleha Shalom, she was featured on the front cover. We should do this once. I'll show you the Life magazine. My great aunt was on the front cover of Life magazine because they were looking to feature the Jewish religion. They wanted an out-of-town, out-of-New-York family of three generations of Orthodox Jews. So they found this family on a farm. And my grandmother told me that she would go because there were Hasidic rebbes who lived in Williamsburg, and they would only drink what is called Chol of Yisrael, milk that was Jewish milk supervised. So she would take the train from the farm. Her family had cows, and she would deliver milk to various rebbes. She told me that she once went, I think it was in the early, mid-40s, she went to the home of the Satmar Rebbe, and she was there delivering milk. She comes into the house, the apartment, and there's a woman scrubbing the floor, and she just walks right by her, and she went to the kitchen, she delivered the milk. She came back later, when she was leaving, she found that it was the Satmar Rebbetzin who was scrubbing the floor because they were so poor and they had nothing and no one that she couldn't hire a cleaning lady. This Hasidus now has tens of thousands of followers, is enormous. And this was a Hasidus that was almost completely decimated in the Holocaust. And you go one to the next. And yet there's a tremendous resurgence. So I think number one is that speaks to the fact that people are looking for this. That's number one. Number two is there's an interesting observation that even in, let's say, a centrist Orthodox community, there is a big movement now that has attracted a lot of attention of interest in Hasidic learning and Hasidic approach to life and the importance of affect and devotion. So that is something which is taking a lot of traction now, even in centrist community. Now, it happens to be that, I mentioned at the beginning, this is very personal to me, because not only are both my mother's and father's families both from Hasidic homes, and we also grew up, as a child, our family, we grew up in a Hasidic shtiebel, and this kind of will transition us to the person we're going to talk about today. The Rebbe of our shtiebel was a Rav in a small Hungarian town before the war called Brid, which was in, I guess, the Satmar... B-R-I-D, Brid. I have no idea how that's spelled in real life.
No.
But it's probably spelled like with two Z's and an S and something like that. But so we were very, you know, I grew up very much attached to that tradition. And I could feel how important that is as part of my... So when I read this article, when I came across this article, I'm like, this, I think, is as relevant today as it was in the 70s. And especially for those of us who are thinking about the Holocaust, these questions are going to keep coming up. So if you think about a theological response, this, I think, is a really important one. So this will transition us to talk about one person. We've talked about in the past, we've talked about the Piasetzna Rebbe from the Warsaw Ghetto. We talked once about the Klausenberger Rebbe, focusing on DP camps. Today we're going to focus on a different Rebbe. He's known as the Papa Rav. He's from a small Hungarian town called Papa, spelled P-A-P-A in Hungarian. So turn your page over to page 4. You see a picture of him. His name was Rav Yosef Greenwald. Rabbi Yosef Greenwald, you see on the top of your map, Papa is in the middle of Hungary. You see it's like a stone throw from Vienna. This is Google Maps. Top left is Vienna. Mid right is Budapest. And then you have a lot of other names that I can't pronounce. He was a rabbi, also a Rosh Hashiva. If you see that, go left on, I don't know what that is, Route 535. I've never been to Hungary, so... you see where it says Szombathely? I think that's, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it.
Yes.
So he was also a rabbi in that town. You see on the bottom right, this is from the cemetery in New York. This is his headstone. Kvod Kedushas, the grand rabbi, Rabbi Yosef, the son of Rabbi Yaakov Yechizkiyahu Greenwald from Papa, the son of Rav Moshe ben Amram, the author of, a, if you see in the Hebrew letters there, Arugas Habosim, great Hasidic master. So this Rabbi Yosef was born in 1905, the son of the grand rabbi of Papa. He was born in Brezhevitz, Hungary. I think that's how it's pronounced. As a young man, he distinguished himself as a proficient Talmud scholar, and he was a Rosh Hashiva and a Dayan in a community that may be known to you, known as Satmar. He was highly, highly regarded in the Satmar Hasidic community. His family also had connections. I'll tell you exactly. This was from Hamaor. This is a small thing that was written up when he died. There's actually, if you want, Aaron Saraski, who has written a lot of biographies about pre-war, has about 450-page biography on this Rabbi Greenwald. He was also, their family was connected with Belzer Hasidim, which is a whole other story about how the Belzer Rebbe escaped from Europe. In 1941, when his father passes away, he moves to Papa and he becomes the rabbi of the community, the Hasidic master, and the Rosh Hashiva, together with his students. So in 1944, the Germans occupy Hungary, and the vast, vast majority of the community is taken to Auschwitz, where there are almost no survivors. He had, at that time, a whole family and his students, but, as we will see from the story in a minute, he had a different trajectory. So what we're going to study today is a selection from a work that he published. The English part, which you're going to see in a second, comes from this volume from Esther Farbstein. Farbstein is the same author as several other books that we've quoted. This is called The Forgotten Memoirs. Esther Farbstein, and this is a translation from the original Hebrew, Esther Farbstein went through different Torah books, scholarly works of different rabbis, and found that many of them have autobiographical notes in the introduction, reflecting on their Holocaust experience. These are rabbis who survived the war and wrote afterwards about what their life was like and what their experience was like. So she has, the original Hebrew has more, she says. One of the rabbis that we have in here, which we're not going to focus on today, was Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Meisels, Rav of Weizen. Right? That's right. You knew him? Right? He came to Chicago. He wrote a sefer called Mikatshei Hashem. In the introduction, which is published here, they published it separately in English. This is published by the Weizner Cheder. The Cheder, they're on Pratt. On Pratt, it's called the Weizner Cheder in memory of Reb Tzvi Hirsch Meisels. So in the introduction to his volume, he says, let me tell you what happened. Which... Oh, it is instant.
Yeah,
where is it?
Upstairs, when you go right where Skokie, on the other side, towards the end of the Skokie March.
Yes.
That adjacent
it's
wall.
Right next to the Holy Soul milk bottle.
Right.
Okay.
And those glass things.
I'm sorry, tell me the author again.
So the author is Esther Farbstein. This book is entirely in English. I've Xeroxed the whole chapter for you. You'll get it in a second. So this Rabbi Yosef Greenwald, his father was a Hasidic master. His father published Torah Insights. So right before the war, the son, this rabbi, the one that you're looking at here, Rabbi Yosef Grunstein, publishes in 1944, I think it was early 44, maybe just slightly earlier than that, just before the Nazis arrived, first publishes his father's Torah Insights. That's what he publishes. His father wrote on a bunch of different topics, and the sefer was called Vayaged Yaakov, and Yaakov spoke, because his name was Yaakov. And so this is the teachings that he taught to his students about the parsha, about the holidays, the Torah readings. Fine. So the son publishes them. This is what Rabbi Yosef Grunstein publishes them. Then, after, he publishes them again with another introduction. So it's fascinating. We're not going to read the first one, but you compare the first introduction, which is, these are my father's teachings, this is everything, da-da-da-da, and then the second introduction, written 3 years later, just after the war. And now he has a special new introduction. And that is the page that you're looking for, looking at in the Hebrew. This is not in English. This is in the Hebrew. Hakdamas ben HaMechaber, the introduction of the son of the author. So this is his father's work. Now, this Rabbi Yosef, you should know, he also wrote many works on this, many works, including a work of halacha on the laws of a mikvah, which we're studying actually in the Kollel this year, how to construct a mikvah. So this is his introduction, the second introduction, Tufshin Zion, so 1947, to the previously published work that his father wrote. And he says, I'm going to thank God the fact that I'm here. And I gave you the whole thing just in case one day you want to come back to it. Go to page 7, because I want you to just see the end. How does he conclude this introduction? He says, go to page 7. Hakosev, I'm writing, Belev Nishbar, with a broken heart, Venitke, and smashed, Umitzapel Yeshua Yisrael, looking forward to the salvation of the Jewish people. His name, you see there, Yosef, Hakatan, the small ben, the son of my father, the author of this, who was before the Av Bezdin of the Jewish community in Papa, that's Pe Aleph, and Sambatali, that small Hungarian town that you saw on the map just west, Ukaes, and now I am living where? Can anybody read that? Those Hebrew letters, where is he living in 1947? That's right. So where is he after the war? Belgium. He goes then from Belgium to Brooklyn, where he reestablishes the Hasidic Center in Williamsburg, and it still exists today in different communities. Look at the bottom section. What does it say? This is the conclusion. Av HaRachamim. What is Av HaRachamim? What is that? What's that? What is that prayer that we say on Shabbos? It is a memorial prayer. So he is now introducing the book with a memorial prayer. The original Av HaRachamim that we say in synagogue every Shabbos in Ashkenazi communities is a memorial prayer to the martyrs of the Crusades. He takes this prayer and he modifies it for the dedication. Who is he remembering? Second line. Ha'isha, right? Ha'chasidim, the pious. Who are these people? He gives you names. He says, Ha'isha ha'tzadekes, the woman who is a tzadekes, Eishes Ne'urim, my young wife. Her name was Chana, the son of the Rav of Chust. And all of the children that she raised in holiness, their names were my children, my sons, Moshe, Eliezer, David, Yisachar, Dov, my daughter Miriam, my twins, Amram, Yehuda, and Meir. I don't know if they were twins. Take that back. Amram, Yehuda, and Meir, Yehoshua, his daughter Perel Chaya, Akiva Yecheskel, and Ephraim Shraga. 10 children. Yizkarei Melokeinu Litova, God should remember them for good, and he should avenge their blood. This is the modified Av HaRachamim for his own family, because his wife and 10 children were taken to Auschwitz. Unbelievable. So this is the new introduction. The first introduction is, this is my father's sefer. The second introduction is, it should be dedicated to the wife and 10 children who were taken away from him. And yet he comes to America and he remarries and he has a new family. This was actually the story of our Rebbe, of our shul, growing up. His name was Rav Amram Taub, Zichrona Levracha. And he had a wife and children before the war. And then he came to America and then he got remarried and he had a new family. So my father once asked him, do you ever think about your other family, your first family? So he apparently he said that he thinks about them at Simchas. He said, at this child's grandson, I think how old my other children would have been. So it's oyem v'nora, it's hair-raising. And yet he had the ability, you know, in our shul growing up, you talk about the feel, the affect of Hasidism. In our shul, do you know who the candy man was? The Rebbe was the candy man. This was a man who hardly spoke English with long white socks, weisse Socken, and the beard, and the, you know, he went to the mikveh. Not only, we used to have a break on Rosh Hashanah before tikkios, before the shofar blowing, because not only did he go to the mikveh on Erev Rosh Hashanah, and not only did he go to the mikveh in the morning of Rosh Hashanah, he went right before the tikkios. So we had to have a pause in the davening. The davening was very long, as you could imagine. And we didn't have kiddush. There was no eating before the tikkios. But the Rebbe had to go to the mikveh. And I could still hear and see in my mind's eye this old man. And he was, late in life, he was so old that he could barely get out one blast of the shofar. He would stand there hunched over in his talus with the shofar. That was the experience. And he was the candy man. This man whose whole family had been killed out by the Germans, who rebuilt his life, who came to Baltimore, because the Satmar Rav, when he came to America, says, go to Baltimore, they could use a shtiebel. So that's what he did. So the fact, the spiritual heroism of these people to be able to rebuild their lives and their communities, it's unbelievable. Yeah.
So there's a book called, I think it's called Man's Search for Meaning, mm-hmm. by Frankl.
Yeah. Yes.
And there's a lot of the same that comes from that book in terms of how you choose to look at something.
That's right. And that relates to the what and why,
right.
You know, that Mickey was talking about before.
Yeah.
Do you remember that you talked in previous sessions about resistance?
Yes. Yes, so I was just going to say, this was a perfect segue to the two points that I wanted to make today, which is, A, this itself is a form of resistance, right? That on Rosh Hashanah, this man, whom I remember in his 80s, was flanked by his new son, at that time he was in his 50s, and his grandchildren and great-grandchildren blowing the shofar. That itself is a form of resistance. That's one aspect. But then what I want to share with you, turn the page. I gave you the whole chapter here from Esther Farbstein's book, which is from a later introduction in the same work, where you actually see not just the resistance afterwards of rebuilding their lives, what his spiritual resistance looked like in a labor camp. A lot of time we talk about death camps. I want to focus now specifically on this labor camp. And this introduction, it's not the copy of what you saw on the first two pages. The first three pages, the Hebrew, that's the introduction to the whole volume. This is in the introduction to the third section, to Sefer Vayikra, the third of the books. I don't know why he structured it this way, but this is where, in the beginning of the book, the Hebrew section that we just saw, there he gives you a little outline. He says, I was taken to a labor camp. I was taken, you know, I went here and there. But he doesn't get into the details. Here, I didn't give you the Hebrew, I just gave you the English. If you want, I can give you the Hebrew. Here, he gets into the actual details of what was going on in his life and the kind of spiritual resistance that he engaged in while he was there, how he chose to live. So go skip over to page 9. So he describes how they first got a hold of him, because as you know, in Hasidic communities, they're very careful about how they bake matzahs. Growing up, in the back of our shtiebel, there was a garage that was converted into a matzah bakery, which, as kids who love pyro, we were given the job of manning the metal garbage can in which we could burn all of the matzahs that got folded over. Because on Erev Pesach, if you have a matzah that gets folded onto itself, it might become chametz. You have to burn it right away. So the adult men were inside, and you could hear them, you know, yelling, these are matzahs for Pesach, matzahs for Pesach. I still remember this. I'm an old European Jew, but I'm not actually an old European Jew. But I saw this with my own eyes. So they would bake matzahs inside, and we would burn the bad matzahs outside. They wouldn't let us inside.
That was a good idea.
Yeah, it was a very good idea. So they have to draw special water. It's called Maim Shalanu. It's supervised water. So many Rebbes would go and draw their own water. So the Papa Rav describes that he went out to get Maim Shalanu, and somebody saw him. And they saw him with a container that he was running somewhere, and they thought that there was something suspicious, and then they dragged him out, and that was how he was ensnared. He was going to get water for baking the matzahs for Pesach. So that's how they got him in the spring of 1944. So he describes that, now go to the second column on page 9, he describes how he was their prisoner. Often they struck me, they bloodied me, they stripped my mantle from me, the watchman of the wall. Our taskmasters forced me to wear a soldier's cap. Now, who wants to read this piece? Because this is amazing. Yeah, Debbie, go ahead.
Which troubled me because of the prohibition against shotness.
What is shotness? Does anybody know? Shotness. What is shotness?
A mixture of two fabrics.
Right, wool and linen together. Could you imagine that a man in a work camp, in a work detail, what is he worried about? That his cap has shotness. Is that resistance or what? Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. So go ahead. So look what he does. He's a chachma.
One night we secretly ripped out the linen part. Before we were able to do this, I thought of a provisional solution. If we wore another small cap underneath it, then we would not be deriving any benefit from wearing their outer cap, which we wore only because we were forced to.
And then he gives you a Talmudic analogy to demonstrate that if you wore a hat under this hat, it wouldn't be a violation of shotness. Skip to the next page. Who wants to read about Shabbos? Shabbos in their work detail in Hungary. Who's got the next piece? Go ahead. So why don't you start left-hand column on... where it says, during this period.
Oh, okay.
During the period.
During the period of forced labor, we did not abandon our merciful Father because we were together with friends who were Torah observant and God-fearing. Thus, we were able to support each other.
So, by the way, this is a very strong feature of Hasidism, the idea of bringing people together, of strengthening each other, of the emphasis, the focus on camaraderie. There's a great Hasidic master who writes that in some circles, before the high holidays, you know what people would do? They would seclude themselves, and they would do a lot of internal introspection, which is important. That's the high holiday season is for that. But he says, in our community, you know what we emphasize? Getting people together. Because being together can strengthen our resolve to improve ourselves, rather than isolating ourselves. So skip that till the next line, although we were forced. Next line, go ahead, two down.
Each man?
Go down one next line, although.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Although we were forced to work on Shabbos as well, we used stratagems to avoid or minimize violating Shabbos in whatever way was possible. God knows the extent of our distress due to this.
So imagine they're trying to figure out what they can do on Shabbos that won't be a technical violation of the biblical Shabbos. So they're maintaining that the Germans could not take away from them. The Hungarians couldn't take this away from them. They're maintaining, to the extent possible, he says, God knows that we maintained our Shabbos. Turn the page over, skip the next page.
So I'm concerned.
Yeah,
I'm
sure.
Acknowledged it.
That's one. And he says, so for example, I'll give you an example. If you are required to write something on Shabbos,
right.
So if you write with your right hand in your normal way of writing, that's a creative action. We call that a malacha, and that's a biblical violation if you write. But if I'm a right-handed person and I write with my left hand, how does my left hand writing come out?
Not
so good. And is that the normal way of writing for a right-handed person? No. So that, technically speaking, is not a biblical violation of Shabbos. Because it's not the normal way of doing things. Similarly, let's say you have... By the way, in Israel, they're very sensitive to this about Shabbos observant for doctors. It's a complicated story. I did see once a volume that said, but I don't think, at least my teachers did not rule this way, practical halacha when one of our children was born on Shabbos, one sefer did suggest that a woman who is ready to deliver and she needs to get to the hospital, she should take a bicycle. Because this way she wouldn't violate Shabbos. So I'm like, when I read that, I'm like, okay, Nechama, those of you who know her, she's like, I don't think that, you know, I called my rabbi, I'm like, Rav Shechter, Rabbi, do you think Baisley is like, I don't know who wrote that, but do me a favor, get that book out of your house. Like, so, but the point, the concept is, which is an important concept that, you know, that's an extreme formulation that most rabbinic authorities would never advocate. But the idea that just because you have to desecrate Shabbos doesn't mean that you forget Shabbos, and it doesn't mean that you don't try whenever possible, reasonable, to minimize the desecration of Shabbos. Exactly. So let's say I have a book, and theoretically I have to carry this book from one domain to another domain. So that would be a violation of carrying from one. But let's say two people carry it together. If two people carry it together, that's very unusual. So
but
that would... Great. So that's a good question. Every circumstance. So in my case, I carry with both hands, so it wouldn't be a help. But let's say if somebody maybe carried it between their legs, like this, or whatever, he's saying, we were very creative. He's saying, whatever strategy we could use, in that way, we were still Shomer Shabbos. We had to work on Shabbos, but that didn't stop us from being Shomer Shabbos in this work camp. What an unbelievable thing. And no one could take that away from them. If that's not resistance, right? That's tremendous spiritual resistance. So that also, the machshava, of course, that's what he's saying. God knows we were, in our mind, we were doing. So let's go, I'm going to give you one more example before we wrap up. Go to page 10. He talks about Rosh Hashanah. And this is amazing. On Sukkot, 10 lines down. On Sukkot, our joy was as one who has discovered a treasure. We found a treasure on Sukkot. How? I'm on page 10 on the left-hand column. How? Because we were able to fulfill the mitzvah of eating in a sukkah that we had secretly constructed in a hidden corner. Similarly, on Chol HaMoed, we found, that's the intervening days in the middle of the holiday, we found foxholes in the field where we worked that had been dug for soldiers to take cover when shooting cannons. We gathered straw and covered a foxhole with it to make a sukkah. A sukkah in a foxhole by a bunch of Jewish laborers. That's Hasidic life in the labor camp. V'chehena, v'chehena, and so on and so on. I gave you the whole chapter. But this man, and you can read the rest on your own, but this man, Rabbi Grunwald, is demonstrating to us what Hasidic, I want to be careful. We've said this before. We're not overgeneralizing. This wasn't the case for every person. It's not the case for every Hasidic community. It's not the case for every Hasidic rabbi or every follower. But this is a window into an approach of serving God with joy and the ability, the superhuman capacity to stay connected with God, that God is a part of your everyday life, wherever you are, even in the most dire circumstances. And to feel that connection and maintain it all the way through. So this is going to be, you'll read the rest of the story on your own. You take the packet. It's incredible. And then come back to what happens afterwards. He ends up in Belgium. And then in 1947, and he reconstitutes his yeshiva. He moves to New York. And there he has the following. And this is not the only one. You could think about Rav Yisrael Spiro, the Blue Shiva Rebbe, who we've quoted, that's a very prominent figure in Yaffa Eliach's works. She was very close to the Blue Shiva Rebbe. And others, the Sadma Rebbe, also a survivor, and the Belzer Rebbe who went to Israel, and many other Hasidic masters. Now, I have a whole book, an entire book devoted to Hasidic masters who were murdered in the Holocaust. But those who survived and maintained this energy and their enthusiasm, their ability to create a joyful Judaism, that's what they transplanted in America and in Israel in their new centers. He actually went back to Papa after the war to try to rebuild some semblance of the community, and then they found out. Because during, he didn't really know what was happening to everyone. Only after the fact did they really find out what was happening to everyone. So they picked up and they restarted. And so he rebuilt a Hasidic dynasty, which exists to this day. Some of you actually eat, they're very popular Hasidic matzah bakery. So there's the Puppet Salem Matzah Bakery. If you're ever in Williamsburg, you can pick up their matzahs. But the idea of looking at Hasidism in general as an approach to thinking about the Holocaust, and looking at Hasidic masters as models for spiritual resistance is one that I think hopefully can enhance our experience. Yes?
Do you know the percentage. So
I don't know. It's a great question in terms of the change of experience. Some of that, I suspect, had to do with the Holocaust. You know, look at Elie Wiesel himself. You know, he came from a Hasidic family and didn't have the outward trimmings. Some of that had to do just with Americanizing. So let's say on my father's side, their family came to America. They were deeply Hasidic, so they were very rooted in the internal traditions, which is why I'm still at home. We have a lot of Hasidic traditions, but they decided externally they wanted to fit into America, and so they were totally observant, but I don't have at least right now, I don't have. Yes, so what did she say?
I never wanted to look like Jewish.
Interesting.
And my mother was such a Zionist and loved everything Jewish. And she hardly looked that Jewish, that being my mother. But she said, I can't.
Interesting.
But they found by Rabbi Peter.
Yes,
I didn't think of his reads.
Right.
So that's part of your answer.
Right.
That
was.
And
that
was in the Shtetl.
Because that was, right. And I suspect it was probably a personal decision in terms of what person's experience was and what it meant to be transplanted into a new country. But the fact that Hasidism has skyrocketed from, you know, over the last 60, 70 years is a testament to the power of this message and how relevant it is to this day. People vote with their feet. That's the bottom line. And yes, you probably will find in the Skokie Library a handful of books of people who did not have a good experience in the Hasidic community. My impression is, by the way, that those people, they'll find books like Unorthodox or other ones of people who left that fold. If you look carefully at them, many of them have a common thread of a broken life, God forbid, lo aleinu, abuse and things like that, that have nothing to do with Hasidus.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that the Hasidic community is perfect, and it doesn't mean that we should adopt all of their communal standards and practices. But what it does mean is that the core tenets of Hasidus that Elie Wiesel is identifying, we should think about that seriously and how we want to incorporate that in our lives and as we approach the Holocaust, irrespective of whether or not we're going to live in and subscribe to a Hasidic community in specific. Yeah, last two comments, Sharon.
So we were just having a conversation Sunday about this new book came out and teachings in Elie Wiesel's classroom, and till his last class, he still based so much of his teaching off of the Hasidic teaching stories, personalities, way of life, even in Boston University. So it never stopped.
And that's what you see in this book, and that's what the first book review emphasizes, is the central tenets of Hasidus and how that's a part of Elie Wiesel's life. Yeah, Shel,
I have to marvel at your clarity and your enthusiasm for this subject. Because you see, I haven't heard the name Mises in over 70 years because I've been through that home. My dad was involved in getting the Mises family and the clan settled back on Hamlin Avenue in Chicago, where our cheder was and where our shul was. My dad was involved in that. But it's been a long time since I heard that name. And I've been to that house several times and saw him. Listen to him.
Did he speak English or only Yiddish?
He spoke, if I remember correctly, he spoke both. He spoke English and he spoke Yiddish. But I was so put out by that whole milieu that I didn't have the knowledge or the enthusiasm to hold on to whatever moments I could have had with him. And so I've lost the Jew appeal.
You share it now. You share it together.
It's a whole different story. That was an amazing experience. I remember today.